series After the American Century, Fears and Hopes for America's Future. And I think it's a very good time, about time, that we had Dan Rogers come. With all the disagreements in American politics that we talked about in the series, but also see in the news all the time, there is a text that's sacred to all parties and factions, at least metaphorically, and to many people in politics, it's actually literally sacred, the U.S. Constitution. Thinking about Dan's work made me think, how far have we come? Because the Constitution begins, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, a variety of other things too, and promote the general welfare to ordain and establish this Constitution of the United States. It struck me that somebody hearing Thomas Mann's lecture on polarization, letting that sink in, might wonder, is there a we the people anymore? I think there are deep doubts that one might have as to whether the economic challenges that Richard Freeman described, the moral policy, the foreign policy challenges that Marilyn Young described, are going to be met by people who constitute we the people. And even more deeply, it seems to me that in both crude and sophisticated political discourse, conceptions of we the people trying to promote the general welfare have increasingly been displaced by appeals to individuals who want to be convinced on the basis of what's in it for me. Well, how did that transformation happen? Is it a burden in trying to meet the challenges of the 21st century? If it is a burden, is there any way back to something closer to people confronting the task of promoting the common good? I can think of no better person to address these questions than Dan Rogers. His powerful insights into the transformation of conceptions of the common good, of we the people, to market-based individualism, above all, an age of fracture, have illuminated this history and make people think, is there a possibility of change? Mary Beth Norton of the History Department will tell you more about Dan Rogers' work, and then he will talk to us on the topic beyond our age of fracture, on the past and prospects for change in the moral presuppositions of American politics.
I'm very pleased to be here to introduce Dan Rogers, the Henry Charles Lee Professor of History Emeritus at Princeton University. Professor Rogers was educated at Brown and at Yale, and he taught at the University of Wisconsin in Madison before joining the Princeton faculty in 1980. At Princeton, he has chaired the history department for more years than I can imagine anyone surviving, as I noted from his CV. And he's also run the Shelby Cullum Davis Center for Historical Studies, which is one of the most important postdoctoral centers in our field, and which I was lucky enough to be at for a year, but before he was there. So I was his predecessor, in one sense, at the Shelby Cullum Davis Center. He's also been a Fulbright lecturer in Japan and Germany. And in 2003-2004, he was key professor of American history and institutions at the University of Cambridge. And this means I can actually say about him something that I have never said about any other visiting lecturer at Cornell, which is that we lived in the same house. the house of the Pitt professor, because I had the Pitt professorship 2 years after he did. So actually, I remember I emailed him before I went to ask about the quirks of the house, which are infamous among historians. And there's a huge file in that house of information on, from past Pitt professors as to how you navigate this house. It's a wonderful house, but it has its quirks. Anyway, I thank you publicly for helping me live in that house for a year. He has held major fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, from the National Endowment for the Humanities, and from the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences as well. Now, he has a very distinguished record of publications, of articles, and especially books. His first book, The Work Ethic in Industrial America, 1850 to 1920, was recently republished in a new edition, which is amazing for a book that was originally published in 1978. It won the Frederick Jackson Turner Prize, which is a prize for the best first book in American history, from the Organization of American Historians. His second book, Contested Truths, Keywords in American Politics Since Independence, which was published in 1987, examined the usage of crucial concepts in American history, and I suspect led him to some of his more recent work. I have to say it was something that people consult when they're thinking about how words have been used in the American past. In 1998, he published Atlantic Crossings, Social Context in a Progressive Age, Social Politics, sorry, in a Progressive Age, which returned to his initial interest in the Progressive Era, and which won prizes from both the Organization of American Historians and the American Historical Association, which are the two largest historical organizations in the United States. Now, as Professor Miller just explained, what makes him an ideal participant in this lecture series is his most recent book, Age of Fracture, which won the Bancroft Prize, yet another prize. I mean, you're getting a trifecta of major prizes here, which was published in 2011, and which looks at the era of fragmenting consensus in the last quarter of the 20th century, and which has set the stage for today's sharp political disagreements, of which we have just had a prime example with the 16-day shutdown of the federal government. And so please welcome me in joining in welcoming Daniel Rogers.
Thank you. Thank you, Dick. Thanks, Mary Beth. Thank you for coming. We got the volume. This sounds, it's okay. Good. Seemed a little echo chambery there, but it's an honor to be part of this series to try to think about the century we're in, the century we're headed toward, and American life inside of that period. When I accepted this invitation, I didn't know how apropos the term fracture might still be when I asked Dick if he would put it in my title. I didn't know how urgent the notion of fracture would seem this fall. But of course, there's talk about fracture everywhere. It's in everybody's title in one way or another. It's on everyone's mind. It's where we seem to have found ourselves in the United States in 2013. So Timothy Noah uses the term the Great Divergence to talk about the growing, steadily growing, accelerating distance between the rich and the poor. Charles Murray's new book, really fascinating new book on what he sees as the fracturing of the white working and middle class, about class and culture coming apart. He calls, using that title, Coming Apart. And if you've seen George Packer's new book, where he sets off to look for America, he finds no America whatsoever, but a whole series of quite quirky stories of people trying to make it in America, and he calls the book The Great Unwinding. And of course, in Washington, in the state houses, where we were taught that forms of deliberation were supposed to be fostered, where we thought people came together to try to do something that had to do with public life, these arenas are now shouting matches between politicians who can barely stand each other and barely speak to each other, and when they do, don't seem to be speaking in the common tongue. So divergence to... Try again? Okay. divergence, division, disaggregation, it's all around us. And of course, it's not just in the air of talk and discussion. There has been, in the etched into the social fabric of recent American life, a dramatic reversal of one of the major trends of the 20th century, which was the growing equalization of the fortunes of the rich and the working class. Not so that they came out equal, but one could think in from the late 1930s and 1940s, 1950s on, that slowly the massive distances between the social classes and economic classes in the United States might begin to shrink. Starting sometime in the 1970s, that trend has reversed. It has accelerated in our own time. And so a talk of fracture, talk of disaggregation goes together, in fact, with a steadily growing distance between the rich and the rest of us. There's political partisanship whose intensification, as we know, right up to the brink of full-scale crisis, seems quite unprecedented. There appears to be even a disintegration of the social glue that many people can remember, that Charles Murray remembers, perhaps fantasizes a bit about. And so more Americans, it is said, live in social ghettos, places where other similar Americans live, where they do not have to encounter a person very unlike themselves. Murray calls them the fish towns of the world, where people wear baseball hats and fish, actually fish, and the Belmonts, where they wouldn't be caught dead wearing a baseball hat, and they don't know how to fish either. They just know how to make money. So there's a sense, not only that there's more talk about the nation coming apart, but there are real divisions, unprecedented, at least in a while. Well, you come with issues like this to an historian, as the historians in this room will know, and it's always a grave disappointment. Because the historian's curse is that she or he will say, well, you know, there were times that were that bad. We've seen it all before. Nothing so new. The distance between the rich and poor, yes, it's quite dramatic, and it's getting worse at this moment, but it's not nearly as bad as the late 19th century, let me tell you, when the plutocracy was even more plutocratic than the current one, and there was so little social floor underneath the economy that those in the working class and the bottom parts of the working class were more abjectly poor than most Americans are now. So what else is new? That's, as I say, the historian's curse. A sense of cultures at war is as old as the nation. The revolution was an inner civil war as well as an independence movement against the English. Think about the fierce attacks upon the loyalists during the American Revolution. Think about the fierce anti-Catholicism in this country all the way through the 19th and early part of the 20th century. Think of the cultural revolutions of the 1960s, about which now Nick Salvatore and others have written so well about, when the place really seemed to be dividing down fault lines of culture. We seem placid in comparison. And as for political dysfunctionality, terrible as what we live in now, it's not quite as terrible as when Preston Brooks in the Senate of the United States beat a Charles Sumner so savagely with his cane that he had to be carried out and nursed back to health over the issue that was to break up the country completely, which was slavery. So, anything new? Anything new? Well, I want to talk about what I think is new in our own times and a little bit about how it came to be, though I'll leave some of that for the question and answer period if you want to pursue that, and then about the resources and possibilities for changing those trends now. And I want to do that through four possible scenarios of the future toward the end of this lecture. I warn you, three of those possible scenarios for the future of American political and moral life in the 21st century. Three of them are pessimistic, but one is not. You may take your choice at the end. So what was new about what I call the Age of Fracture? That is the period in our history since the mid-1970s. It's not just this confluence of economic and political trends, though of course it's partly that. And they set the frame in which we now live. But it was, I think, still more a sea change in the dominant assumptions of self and society that had gathered force at the beginning of the 20th century in the United States, and then and held together through the middle of the century, and then in the last quarter of the 20th century, since I say sometime in the 1970s, began to fall apart. There was a sea change in the dominant social imagination, in which the language in which Americans talked about themselves, talked about politics, and talked about social relations shifted and cracked. And of all the fractures, this one, I think, was the most important. Now I know we are taught, we may even be taught in programs in ethics and public affairs, that ideas, you know, they can't matter that much. They can't possibly be as important as the things that have more material claim upon a life. Ideas are said to be swept in the tide of larger historical forces. They come along like chips down the river. But that's not true. Well, it's only partially true. If ideas, of course, are always in the push and pull of experience, ideas frame experience at that very same time. They set limits on what can be imagined. They channel desires. They explain and construe the world. They make certain things taboo, and they make other things, and this is even more important, they make other things natural, so natural that they don't need to be thought about or questioned or interrogated. They set the pictures in our heads, the metaphors that we live by. And let those frames of thinking about selves and society, let them shift, let them crack, and the consequences are immense and wide-ranging. Everything is destabilized, and everything comes up for grabs. Richard Weaver, the conservative writer, is known for the phrase, ideas have consequences. And it became a staple of conservative rhetoric in the 1980s, but it has great truth value to it as well. Or as Irving Kristol put the point in 1975, what rules the world is ideas, because ideas define the way in which reality is perceived. The way in which reality is perceived shifted, I think, in the last quarter of the 20th century. In different ways, across different terrains, but intersecting terrains of American life. A set of big key ideas, social and moral presumptions about persons, selves, society, politics, that had been that, a set that had been dominant since the middle of the 20th century, cracked. I don't mean to say that the cracking of at this level of language, idea, metaphor, caused the social changes that I'm talking about. If you want to know why wages are so low, think first about the globalization of the economy and the pressure that has produced and the ways in which labor unions are no longer able to resist this as they once were. If you want to know why the rich are so rich, you should think about the finance economy first. If you want to know why politics is as it is now, you should think first about the changes in the rules of the game and the changes in the ways in which the rules of the media have both served to dramatically change the way in which we understand politics, observe politics, and participate in politics. But what changed the changes in the language of the social, as I want to call it, the languages of the social, what those did was to accelerate and to normalize things that might have occurred otherwise, and therefore make them all the harder to see beyond, and hence to alter. It made this seem more natural than it might have. So there's the first part of my argument. What had intellectual and social argument been like before what I've called the Age of Fracture? Well, even to pose that question is to invite a kind of cartoon, and yet I think it's fair to say that to think in terms of history, institutions, and society had been one of the hallmarks of the first three quarters of the 20th century. History, institutions, and society were said to surround the individual self. It encircled that individual self in wider and wider rings of relations and structures and interdependencies. So when you talked about being human, you talked about persons who were born into social norms, whose very personalities were shaped by the forces of socialization. Their life chances were made not so much by themselves, but by the way in which they were sorted out by the institutions of society into which they came. Societies divided people up into castes and classes. They aggregated them under the pressure of mass media and mass society's ways of life. They enveloped them in webs of interdependent economic relations, and they entwined each person into the fate of all, precisely through those historical, institutional, and social bonds. And the forces of history swept over all of it. To go to college in the middle years of the 20th century was, as it is now, a voyage of self-exploration. But it was also to learn that you were not the sole master of your own self, or this thing you called yourself. You learned from Freud, or whatever you, sort of secondhand Freud you got in your lectures, of the conflicting forces in your mind about which you seemed to have no particular cognizance already, but were there, and you were a kind of arena in which they did their work. You learned from anthropology the extent to which your moral convictions were not individually forged, but socially produced. You learned from history how resistant societies were to change. You learned from Keynes about the existence of the macroeconomy, which operated by laws that couldn't be intuited from thinking about individual economic action. You learned from the daily papers of the existence of the Cold War clash of civilizations in which you were a recruit, whether you wanted to be or not. And finally, you learned from the existentialist writers that the very act of claiming selfhood in these circumstances wasn't simple, but it was full of difficulty. It was full of anguish. That's what made the attempt, however certain it was partially to fail, the attempt to claim a self so important because it was so difficult. And this was the common sense of the matter if you went to college. And if you didn't go to college and you didn't read Freud and you didn't read the existentialist writers, you knew most of this just by the push and pull of social experience, that being a self in a complicated mass society was to be in the tide of circumstances. And then in the last quarter of the century, even as all these institutions remained just as powerful as before, these ways of imagining self and society began to break up. Strong notions of society receded from the forefront of language and imagination. Structures and institutions became less powerful, and something else moved up. Something else that had always been there, the autonomously acting, freestanding self, the person just for her or himself, all alone. That side character moved to the center of the stage and took it over, as if this were the natural condition of human beings, to be an unencumbered, perfectly free, unattached person. You found these free agents all kinds of places. Historians started to use a word that they had not bothered with before. They wanted to give people agency. It was one of the things that social historians thought they could do for the people in the past, is to show that they had some choice, that they had some agency in their lives, whereas the generation before had worked so hard to show how little agency they had given the press of circumstances. Economists turned from macroeconomic model making with its highly complex and computer-driven systems to much reduced model making with individual choice-making actors at its core. Social theorists talked about self-fashioning, and conservatives, who had once been among the most articulate explicators of the sanctity of society and history and tradition, conservatives turned, or many of them turned, and by now most of them seem to have turned, libertarian. John Kennedy had moved the nation, or as we imagine he did, by talking about sacrifice. To bear any burden, there would be none that would be too great for Americans to shoulder, given their responsibilities in the world. Ronald Reagan, who's in some ways introduces the new language into public life that I'm talking about, is key in this regard. He used the term sacrifice once in a major address, and then his speechwriters and he decided that it was not a word they would use again. He would much rather talk about freedom, about the open possibilities that lay before everyone in America and before America itself. "There are no constraints on the human mind," his speechwriters had him say, "no barriers to human progress except those we erect, free to be, whatever." And he loved, above all, the line of that radical atheist outsider Tom Paine from the 18th century. Tom Paine's line, "We have it in our power to begin the world all over again," which meant that history didn't matter, really. And the institutions could be whisked away in the social imagination. It meant that what we decided to do, we could just do. So tax cuts would pay for themselves and freedom was on the march. And if I caricature just a little bit, I don't think I caricature too much. He was our cheerleader for an aspirational universe in which what Americans chose to dream could become true by the very intensity of the dream work. And above all, in this new language, choice was everywhere. Not agonizing choice as it had been for the existentialist writers, but as the most natural of human activities. That's what I mean by this rather pretentious word in the title to this talk about changes in the moral presuppositions that saturate or dominate American life. I don't mean change in certain kinds of things that Americans think is good or bad, though these can be really quite important. They're very important now in some of the issues that Americans are deeply divided over. When many Americans decided that slavery was a sin, that had enormous consequences. But I mean something different, not a shift in one or another thing being right or wrong, but a shift in the whole way in which one imagined the relationship between persons and society, oneself in the world. The very image of social life. Well, no change this big comes from any individual source. Ideas work at many levels. Let me tell you simply, briefly, something that you can find it at more length than other things I've written. Some parts of this braided set of forces that came together to create the kinds of shifts that I'm talking about, and then I will move on to my sense of where we might be headed afterwards, or at least give you like the movie Sliding Doors, four different subway routes to take out of where we are. Some of the fracture, some of the disaggregation of the social, some of the movement of this individual choice-making person up to the very center of the social imagination, so it's very hard to see anything else. Some of it took place in the universities, and above all, in the economics departments. And it came, I think, out of an intellectual crisis. There are others who would like to trace this to particular economic schools and to particular conservative parts of the economic profession, but I think much more important was that economics in the 1970s went through a ringer of intellectual crisis. And the ringer was that the economists found themselves put through was the fact that they simply could not predict what might be happening in the economy next. We pay economists now to do that sort of work. What will the rate of whatever be next month, or next week, or better yet, 3 or 5 years out? And economists had gotten pretty good at that. Until suddenly, under the pressure of economic changes in the 1970s, they found they no longer could. High inflation, and high unemployment, which had been certain never to coincide, coincided. They rolled over each other, and nobody knew why. The paradigms that came out of the Keynesian school didn't work. The paradigms that came out of the monetarist school didn't work. Nobody's paradigms worked very well. It was a classic case for those of us who find ourselves or grew up with Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structures of Scientific Revolution, in which shifts in paradigm come out of precisely this failure to make sense of the immediate world around you. It was a classic paradigm shift, and what the younger economists did was to decide that macroeconomics, as it had been taught to them, That is to say, a series of complex interrelationships of economic aggregates tied together with each other, but tied together in such a way as always to be somewhat unstable and always therefore needing to some sort of management, that this no longer was an accurate picture of the world. No economic, macroeconomic model seemed to work. It wasn't because the 1970s were, in fact, a terrible decade as far as economic performance. They're not nearly as bad as the deliberately induced recession of 1979-1983, and they were not nearly as bad in terms of consequences for persons' experiences as the unexpected financial crash of 2007-2008. But as I say, they were the most volatile years of the second part of the century. The Keynesians seemed to get it wrong, and everyone else got it wrong, and nobody knew why they were getting it wrong. And out of that wreckage came the turn in economic thought, which still defines economics in our day, which is to turn one's back upon those macroeconomic indicators as at least the first place in which to build one's model, and to go back to much, much smaller two-actor, three-actor puzzles that might illuminate what was going on. Ronald Coase, as many of you will know, won the Nobel Prize in 1991 for one of the most famous of these two-actor puzzles. He demonstrated, if I could simplify, that if you wanted to think about regulation, business regulation, utility regulation, it was not actually the best thing to do to start with the nature of the thing you wanted to regulate. You shouldn't learn more about telephones or about wireless or about internet or about gasoline or about electricity. You should not think about the history of the industry that needed to be regulated, at least not in the first instance. And you certainly didn't need to think very much about questions like capitalization or institutional structures. What he convinced us was, think in the first instance of a farmer and a rancher that live side by side, and the fence is not very good between them. And therefore, the rancher's cows get in the farmer's corn. And they trample the corn, and they eat the corn, and they have a problem. And what he argued there, and it was breathtaking to those who had been thinking in other terms, was that the rancher and the farmer, after through getting mad at each other, would finally meet on the fence, and they would work out a deal. I'll give you this much for the damage that my cattle have caused. And they would bargain it out, and they would reach the optimum solution. And if you knew that, you knew the most important thing about regulation, which was that left to their own devices in a perfect world, the parties themselves would come to a conclusion that was more equitable, that had more gains for all the parties involved, that was more just, that was more efficient than anybody thinking outside that system could devise. There were reduced word pictures like this everywhere in what I've called the Age of Fracture. Jude Waninsky, the journalist, but a very effective one, in a book with a wonderful title called How the World Works, which he published in 1979, said, imagine two people on an island. One was a fisherman and one was a coconut gatherer. And if you got those clearly enough in your head, you would know why high taxation was really unjust. I won't work out the details, but he did. Charles Murray, Losing Ground, another really important book in the period, cut through all the arguments about the justice of welfare supports for the poor and said what you needed to think of was two poor people, Harold and Phyllis. Harold and Phyllis. And they were trying to figure out whether they would be better off if they got a job or if they went on welfare. And once you figured out that was what welfare was about, a two-person problem, people with no past, no social pressures, no constraints upon them, making a choice, then you would have a better guide to thinking about problems of justice in a world of economic inequality than anything else. These were Robinson Crusoe pictures of the world, but it turned out there was a lot you could do with them. Game theorizing, choice theorizing, turned out to be a very, very powerful logical tool. one might say that the Republican Party and our current Congress would have done a lot better if they'd gotten a good game theorist down into the party caucus and had them walk through what the likely options were, given the cards that they had and given the cards that their opponents had. We might have been saved a lot of the mess that we were in. But what these tools also did, consciously and unconsciously, was to simplify one's image of the world as it was. They began to think that what was natural about human life were these two-actor problems. Persons extracted, as I say, from history, from cultures, from power, from domination, where they simply made choices rationally. And what made those choices work was the assumption that in this world clear-cut of larger systems of structure, those choices would, if they were free enough and made in without intervening in person's rationality, they would add up to the best possible world. They would have the fewest inefficiencies. They would bring the greatest aggregate benefits to all. And the thing they called this arena in which choice was made in an optimizing, self-optimizing way was called the market. And that was new. I know you're going to say that the market is a very old term in economics, had been around since Adam Smith, and of course it was. But if you open the Wealth of Nations, you do not find yourself in a marketplace, as you think you might. You're not there with people shouting prices at each other, but you're actually you're in a pin factory. You're in a place of labor and production and discipline and power. And that's what Adam Smith thought, in fact, was changing of the world. And if you go read any page of David Ricardo, you find yourself in a world in which there is a lot of talk about markets, but these are not self-optimizing markets that the Ricardian universe is shot through with pessimism about the kinds of results that might happen. So what happened in the economics departments, and I'm caricaturing a little bit, but not as much as one might, is that not only did the world become smaller, simpler, more individualized, more centered on choice, but the arena in which those choices were conducted became more orderly, more rational, more benign, and ultimately more optimal than any people had imagined economics to work before. From large to small. There were other sites as well in which this happened. Another place where this, and here we find the word we that Dick began with at the forefront of the story. Another place where the presuppositions of moral selves and politics shifted was in the terrain of social movements. Solidarity movements were still going strong when the age of fracture began. Labor union strength was down some from its peak in the late 1950s, but the big drop in labor union membership in the 1970s was not yet visible. African-American freedom struggles, with a strong sense of the race, of us, of we, of what we have lived through and what we therefore can bring to the halls of justice and what we both stand for and in some ways are owed by the past that we have in American history. This is what Jesse Jackson meant by those big rallies where he talked about we. And the modern women's movement was just booming in the 1970s. Sisterhood, like race, like the working class sense of men in solidarity. Sisterhood was powerful, a sense of the solidarity of women's interests across all the other things that might divide them. We shall not be moved. We shall overcome. And our bodies, ourselves, which was, of course, one of the classics of the women's movement. This was in the 1970s, early 1980s. 2 decades later, almost all the solidarity movements had broken up in one way or another. The struggle for tangible women's rights had been sustained. In fact, it had produced results that were probably unimagined at the beginning. But the word we had started to disintegrate. disintegrated because persons discovered that it had been something of an illusion to begin with. It had been a convenient fiction, that there were lots and lots of different kinds of women and they didn't have all the same interests or experiences or ambitions. Morally conservative and politically conservative women began to jostle for the microphones. African-American women began to say that this we had been stretched over them without their consent. But social movements always are in a constant state of fissure in this way. They're always breaking up. They're always being reconsolidated. This is the sort of natural state of which social movements live. What was bigger, I think, was what we might call the ontological fracture, the very notion that there was a category of woman or a category of a person of color. This is, again, a complicated story, but by the 1980s, feminists were no longer writing about us. They were writing about identity as not there, ready to be grasped and articulated, but as fluctuating, as multiple, as shifting, as self-contradictory. Identity was fragmented. It was decentered. My friend Cornel West, who was one of the leading voices in the early 1990s, talking about race, found himself unable to use race in the way that his predecessors had, all the way back to W.E.B. Du Bois. He wanted to talk about something else. I revel in fluidity, he said, in improvisation, in the highly complicated and the paradoxical. I begin with radical cultural hybridity and improvisational new world sensibility. I'm not for a solid anything. Now, Cornel West wasn't being fair to himself. He was for lots of solid things. He cared a lot about the greater equality. He cared a lot about issues of injustice. He cared a lot about forms of social solidarity. But the ability to put that in words, in the words that began with we, became somewhat harder by the time this period was over. The words for the collective experience had slipped away. And finally, though, I'll say this quickly, all these shifts in the realm of ideas toward the small, the personal, the fragments, they had their impact upon politics, as they must. You could see it in the way in which any strong sense of history evaporated from discussions over affirmative action, above all on the Supreme Court, but throughout the rest of society. More and more persons began to say, well, all that history, all that stuff, it doesn't matter anymore. Skip Gates worried that conservatives, but also persons all the way through the mainstream American society, had let history roll up like a carpet so that the past of slavery, the past of the Civil War, the past of Jim Crow, none of that mattered in the now in which the policymakers wanted to live. The civil rights movement was over, the conservatives insisted. Their predecessors had resisted. Conservatives now said the civil rights movement had been won. Fine. To mention it, to mention race now, was to be another kind of racist. It changed radically the arguments over race, as it still does in American society, to see it, as I say, pulled out of its historical context until it became a choice between two claimants for a University of Michigan or Cornell University opposition. Which one are you going to choose? You could see this reduced understanding of the world in attitudes toward the poor, so that the poor were increasingly extracted from the cultures and economies in which they live, from the job markets in which they tried to work, in the pull and pressure upon their lives, from the housing markets in which they found themselves restricted. And they were brought forward one by one as problems in incentives management that the policymakers needed to get better. You can see it in the way in which people talked about the global world. Thomas Friedman is famous for his phrase that the world is now flat, and he meant by that, of course, that things circulate everywhere, and they circulate at the speed of light everywhere. But by the late 20th century, there were global theorists who began to think that that meant that anything could happen virtually overnight. Shock therapy could bring down the Soviet Union. And once the Soviet Union had fallen under its own weight, it could bring capitalism to the places where Soviet economic rules had worked before. The regime in Iraq could be toppled overnight. Democracy could be put anywhere because the world was now flat, meaning that history, institutions, traditions, culture no longer were at the forefront of those planners' minds. And you see it most vividly in the transformation of modern political conservatism. Because conservatives have been the most articulate defenders in many ways of the webs of social relationships in which human beings live. They had stressed culture and tradition. They had been defenders of schools and churches and patriotism. They had been deeply skeptical about the exploding cloud of new rights claims that had come out of the 1960s. Rights were not the most important thing that conservatives like to think about. They were what people on the left used as their slogan. But sometime in the 1980s, and one can tell the story in more detail, and others have begun to do so in a very important way, the radical slogans of the 1960s, the rights talk, the anti-government talk, moved right. You could find Young Americans for Freedom wearing buttons by the late 1980s, Smash the State, which would have been on the t-shirts of a SDS organizer just 20 years earlier. Conservatives initially recoiled against this. There were too many rights, they said. There's too little responsibility, too little respect, too little observance of custom. The Catholic bishops in the early 1980s, before Catholic discourse got quite so overwhelmed by it, the narrower issues in which it's focused now, articulated one of the most strongest and most telling critiques of unchecked capitalist marketplace that one could find in the 20th century. And there are still parts of the church which are deeply involved in living wage movements, trying to think hard about social relationships in our time. This was an authentic conservative voice. But rights talk increasingly invaded conservatism, as we know. Opposition to abortion, which might have been posed in many, many ways about relationships of unborn to mothers, relationships of the unborn to society, was turned into a claim about the rights of the unborn. And so it became a quarrel of rights, those rights against mothers' rights. Advocates of prayer in school began talking about their private rights to pray wherever they wanted. Discussions about taxes turned not about on waste or utility so much as one's right to keep every piece of what one owned against this alien thing called the government, which wanted its own share. In the culture wars, conservatives sometimes talked about trying to restore traditional common standards of virtue. But when it came to schooling, which had been the great engine of socialization in American history, conservatives decamped toward vouchers. To every family, let that family have the education they wanted, the one they chose. In the marketplace of free choice, everybody should have their own choice of education. Freedom was the word that they used, but it meant something quite precise and quite narrow, not a collective freedom, but freedom to choose. Peggy Noonan, who was a conservative speechwriter, as you know, at the Reagan White House, wrote down this little ditty that she thought she picked up from those who came by to bug her about what she ought to write for the president. We'll free up more of your money. We'll free up more of the world. Freedom, freedom, freedom. That became the new conservative slogan. I don't mean to dismiss all of this as only having negative impacts, only being deleterious to a world that one might, but I hope not, turn nostalgic toward. The world of the high Cold War, in which notions of the individual as wrapped up in the structures of best society. These are not times that anybody would like to bring back. There are more ways of being human now than there were in the period before this fracture began. There's scores of ways now of being a woman that were unavailable before, or being a man. There are vastly more choices, in fact. The over-socialized concept of human nature that flourished in the 40s and the 50s is gone, and one would not wish it back. But the evaporation of a stronger language of the social, stronger sense of relationships, both the ones one voluntarily constructed, but the ones that are constructed upon us, the evaporation of that had consequences. And as the language for the collective disappeared, one found politics turn into more of a shouting match than before. Is this the way it will be? I said I would give you four scenarios, and let me try to do that in the time that I have left. One of these scenarios, as I said, there are three nightmares coming first, so one of those nightmares advertises itself as utopia, so you'll have to see. Well, the first possibility, if I'm right at all in this very rapid sketch of where we have come, the first would be more of the same. Without a stronger public language, without a stronger even ability to think in terms of the public, to think in terms of the public good, or a common deliberation toward a public a good, we might be in a state of permanent culture war, where everybody finds him or herself in one's own camp and shouts at the persons on the other side. This word culture war it was new to the 1990s. It came into usage in the wake of the Moral Majorities organization on the right flank of politics, bringing a really radical and a spectacularly disruptive force into politics. And for many of those who have been participants in the culture war, either the left or the right, the word itself is a kind of energizing word. It gives you a sense of doing something really, really important in a world at war. I think most social scientists actually think that the word is exaggerated, or it exaggerates the actual differences between the moral presumptions of persons inside the United States. That if you allow people to say they're not sure, or it's complicated, or they'd like to have it somewhat both ways, if you allow them just the glimmer of a possibility of being ambivalent, they reach for it in much, much larger numbers than you would ever know from the polling that most of us receive. And ambivalence is actually, I think, though I'm editorializing here, a really important moral start toward actual serious moral thinking, when you see more than one side to an issue and you have to think it through. There are Americans who are ambivalent. There are Americans who would like the nation to be more centrist than it appears to be in politics. But what these same experts here on public opinion polling say is that what has shifted is not a increasing polarization of sentiment. What has shifted is the increasing skill of the political parties to pull out, according to certain key test issues, the persons who will find themselves attracted to that party. So the Democratic Party is more monolithic than it certainly was in the 1950s, and the Republican Party is more monolithic than it was in the 1950s. And mass mailing, soundbiting, all these things that serve to polarize politics are a way not of creating us in war with each other as much as pulling into politics those most extreme elements that the public holds. So in that sense, we could have a permanent culture war. It wouldn't be a lot of fighting down on the ground, perhaps, but there would be endless fighting in the halls of the legislatures and the halls of Congress. And as I say, if that's what public life looks like in your imagination anyway, that could sustain itself for a good long while. That seems to me something of a nightmare, but it may be right around the corner. A second nightmare would be a little bit different. The politicians learn that, in fact, too much dysfunctionality doesn't work. They need to compromise on something. They need every once in a while to do something for the public good. A piece of signature legislation would, every once in a while, is good to point to. And so out of these considerations, the Congress manages to pass some more legislation in the public good. But the legislation they pass, this is my foreboding, turns out to be so complicated, so interwoven with the, or so revealing of the compromises that went into it, legislation in which all the various groups that have a stake in that field have been able to make their mark and get the piece of what they need and what they want, in which the compromises are so incredibly complicated that the legislation itself ceases to hold any moral traction for those whom it was designed to serve. I'm thinking of the Affordable Health Care Act, of course, which comparison with Social Security, which maybe experts will tell me seemed pretty Byzantine at the beginning, but wasn't nearly as Byzantine as the Affordable Health Care Act. And people learned to love it and to make rights claim upon it and to think of it as part of the natural order of things. Yes, when you're old, you have paid your dues to society, society needs to pay back. But in the healthcare debate at the moment, I see nothing so simple, no claim that has been articulated that seems to hold the power of affection for what has come out of Congress, or even what, no matter which compromises are made, will come out of Congress. The opponents vilify the Affordable Health Care Act for its new powers of coercion, and particularly they vilify it for aiding the poor, though that's sometimes put in coded words. But our president has a very hard time selling it in any other way than it's a good choice. When you finally get online, you'll discover it's a good choice. You'll do better with it, one by one. So we may have very, very complicated legislation in the public good that will not hold our affections as a public, will not make us a public. And I think that's another nightmare scenario. And it won't be because the politicians aren't trying hard. It will be because the forces of legislation, the dynamics of legislation, and the interweaving of interest groups with policymaking now in the early 20th century is so much more intense than it has ever been before. Perhaps we don't need society. Maybe each of us wired into the great global web or in the cloud, maybe we don't need each other. Maybe that's passé. We can get all kinds of stuff off the web. We can vote in private or homes if we want. We can choose whatever we want to be amused by. Rallies are very retro. We don't need a rally anymore. We can have an electronic petition. We can shop in private. We can get ourselves educated online in private. So public schools, they're pretty costly. They keep on needing new bricks and mortar and all that kind of stuff, and highly paid teachers. We could do it all, maybe, on the web. And if we really like doing things with other people, if we're on a basketball team, we just get on the web and we'll Facebook it up, and we'll get a pretty good basketball team fast. And when its utility is over, we can let it crash. All this deliberation, all this working stuff out, all that thing we call politics, maybe we don't need it anymore in the 21st century. And this image that I've called fracture might, there are those who see it as the utopia of the future. Some of them on the libertarian right, some of them technocrats deep pockets out of Silicon Valley left. There's a convergence upon this idea of a future. And then we won't need the language for social at all. I think that's a nightmare, but it's being sold as utopia. Or maybe, the language for the social will be renewed. There are no return to go cards in history, no getting back to where you started from. But the interconnection of the world, the pressure of society upon us, which makes us not individuals all by ourselves, but always in the world, That hasn't gone away. In fact, the pressures are more complicated and more intense than they ever were before. So it's possible to imagine a renewal of realism in public and political life, where persons, social scientists and universities get deeper actually into the world of experience. Model building ceases to be quite so important, and realism triumphs. If there's going to be a renewal of a new language for the social, I don't think it's going to happen in a big bang. There's a lot of thought that maybe a real big depression, another 1930s, maybe that would bring us to our senses. We've had two big bangs in the most recent years. The one, of course, was the destruction of the World Trade Center towers, and the second one was this huge financial meltdown of 2008. And in both cases, you saw, coming out of the recesses of American society, a very strong sense of collective concern. Because language is never monolithic, and there's always more than one thing going on at one time. If you were down in my part of the world and driving in the New Jersey Turnpike right after 9/11, you saw cars streaming by with flags. And the flags meant lots of things. They meant people were angry. They meant they wanted to go find someone and string them up for this. But they also meant we were in this together. And the journalists talked incessantly about this new we that had been created. But we recall how quickly that evaporated. How quickly that evaporated into a war that turned out to be very unpopular and not work very well. And in the same way, when the financial meltdown took place, there were those who thought it would create a new sense of common experience among Americans. And yet, as that anger and collective concern rattled through society, it launched itself most strongly, not on the left. Despite those Occupy Wall Street rallies, they had almost no serious understanding of what had caused the macroeconomic collapse. Out of that came almost no new economic ideas. The economic ideas were stronger on the right, where the Tea Party organizers found a group of Americans for whom they knew exactly what had happened. What had happened was that certain people had overreached themselves. They had done things that were not ethically right. They had robbed ordinary people like themselves of their future. They put it all in tiny little personal terms. And when some of the more quotable Congress people said, you know, going bankrupt, what's the big deal if the United States goes bankrupt? Because business folks that I know go bankrupt quite frequently, and it all kind of works out. It's this reduction of the large to the small, the macro to the personal. It was there that the concern about the financial collapse has lodged most strongly. Well, I'm almost done here because I have invaded my time, I'm sure. We overstate the ability of crises to change people's minds. Crises nearly as often force people back into the things that they are most comfortable with. And we understate the possibilities of normal social action to help change one's minds. Because the resources buried, made secondary, the resources for a greater sense of we are still there. George W. Bush's head speechwriter, Michael Gerson, wrote as articulately as any speechwriter in the 20th century about commitments, about service, about the poor. He wrote in George Bush's first inaugural that the poor are not strangers, they are citizens. They are not problems, they are priorities. And for the rest of us, we find the fullness of life not only in options, but in commitments. That language was there. And you remember that same turns of phrase, the same commitments in Barack Obama's speeches. You can actually count because the internet does give us powerful things to do. You can count the number of times the word together is used by presidents all the way through the 20th century. Right? You can go back to the 18th century if you want. Kennedy used it once. Nixon used it a lot. And so one of the things you quickly figure out is that a president faced with a Congress in a party that he doesn't control is going to use the word together more than another kind of president, because he's got to try to bring them aboard. But still, they're nothing compared to the rhetorical power of that term together in Barack Obama's speeches. This was the inaugural in 2012. Together we, that was the way the speechwriters did it. Together, comma, we. Together we determined a modern economy, required public investments in roads and commerce. Together we discovered that a market thrives only when there are rules to ensure fair play. Together we resolved that a great nation cares for its most vulnerable. There's a social basis for that. The social Catholicism that was Gerson's basis, the men's clubs that George W. Bush was part of, and the support groups that they helped to give him, the black churches, where some of what Barack Obama, whole rhetorical gifts come from. Compared to persons elsewhere, Americans still spend far more time invested in social and community action than persons elsewhere. The political scientist Thea Scotchwell has turned up her nose at this. When the questions are national, when they're so complicated, when they're so important, what does it mean that in the United States, more grown men than elsewhere, not a majority, but a sizable number, show up every month at a soup kitchen and ladle out soup? What difference is that going to make, she says, to the world of politics? And yet it might. It's possible that the resources for a more complex social understanding of the world are still there, that need time, articulation, and social movements to push them through. There may even be possibilities in the economics departments themselves. There are more economists now who talk about a rationality as bounded, that is to say, not always very rational, who talk about the world of choice as being full of kind of chaos, not just optimizing order. Rationality is limited. That's the point of Daniel Kahneman's thinking fast and slow, as you know, that most of the time what we imagine to be reasonable is not terribly reasonable at all. And last week, in a wonderful coda for this talk, as you know, the Nobel Prize Committee, which was to award the prize in economics, split its judgment in the most extraordinary way. Markets, it said, were perfect. They were instantly self-equilibrating. They acted always as universal optimizing machines. And that's why they gave half of its award to Eugene Famer, because that's what he approved. And markets weren't that at all. In fact, there were places where there were bubbles and confusions and all kinds of irrational and unoptimized outcomes, and that's why they gave the award to Robert Shiller. Well, having praised ambivalence as a beginning point in moral and intellectual wisdom, I take this as a good sign that maybe, even where this revolution began, there's a sense that things need to be and may be different in the future. Well, driving with an historian I like to tease is like driving with somebody, a friend who only looks in the rearview mirror. They don't have no clue what's down the road. They're always, you know. Historians don't have a clue about the future. But perhaps a sense of where we've been and the possibilities that have been left behind might be useful in thinking about where we're going. Thank you. I'll do whatever the custom is.
I think we are polar people, but I just wanted to say a word about the acoustics in this room, which is the only rule in these discussions. It's very hard for people in the audience to hear one another. So if you ask a question, maybe a comment, could you get up and say hi?
You first, then Nick.
Thank you for a really great talk. I was learning that contemporaneous with these systems of a national age of fracture and begins with economic globalization, the end of the Cold War, in the sense of the end of history, a burgeoning environmental movement, in the sense that we're all common inhabitants of a global world. And a few rights, so we all have common human dignity. I wonder if you see a relationship between these two trends, and if you do, if you can speak to what that relationship is.
Well, did you all hear the question? Should I try to repeat it? Did you hear it back there? Okay. clearly, there are lots of ways to connect those movements. Certainly, the global human rights discourse comes straight out of this new emphasis upon individual rights that I talked about. What's interesting about the environmental movement is that the original attempt to change the pictures in people's heads by looking at pictures of globes, by the way the Sierra Club used its extraordinary roster of photographers to make you look at nature in a new way, the way in which certain writers like Ed Abbey and others helped you to think of yourself in a new relationship to the world by the very powerful power of their poetry and their words. The environmental movement now has become, and maybe it's a good thing, much more technocratic. And so that might fit a little bit my story about, well, you know, global warming is it's a very important thing and we certainly should do something about it, but don't ask me to love it. Don't ask me to be passionate, though I appreciate all the people who are. About this, because it is so complicated to know what to do. Fewer sheets of toilet paper, a different vote in Congress. It is complicated, and that's one of the points that we have now learned. But the one thing I would say about these various movements is when people imagine now, we are the world, which was of course a left slogan of the 1960s. I think still dominant, though I hope it's. Has crested, is the notion that when we say we are the world, that means I'm just like this person in Lebanon, and just like this person in Shanghai, and just like this person in the Great Lakes region of Africa. And we all deserve the same rights, and we all deserve the same choices. And there's something both heroic and just terrifyingly naive in that. Nick.
Thanks, Leslie Van. A question. You were talking about the fracturing, and you talked about, you described it in terms of moving to small world, one-on-one, personal, talked about self, talked about agency. You never used the term individualism, and I'm wondering why.
You know, I hadn't thought about that, Nick. It's a good question. Why don't I use the word individualism for this? I think, in part, it's because if we use the word individualism, we find ourselves imagining that it's very old in American culture. It's just the way it always was. Now, of course, individualism isn't very old in American culture, as historians know, but the general public doesn't tend to know this. So that when Ralph Waldo Emerson writes those amazing essays about, you know, the resources of the self, or when Henry David Thoreau says he will be a free person inside society because he owns himself, or when others say that no human being ought to own any other human being, or have power over any other human being, the early radical feminists and the early anti-slavery folks, they were rebels against their culture. But when we say individualism, we tend to think, oh yeah, goes all the way back to Benjamin Franklin. I think in avoiding that term, I want us to think of things that were in fact being produced at that moment different than what we had before. Yes.
Didn't this society shift so much for we're so busy looking across the sea, we don't even look at our neighbor anymore?
I'm not sure everybody could hear that. The question was, don't we now almost never look across the sea?
We look across the sea so much that we don't even look at our neighbor.
Oh, we look across the sea, meaning, well, when we look across the sea, what are we seeing?
We're so busy helping
The concern is that being so concerned with helping Africa, we've forgotten about the poor person on our own street. I'm not actually sure that premise is true. That if you take something like Bill Gates Foundation, which is one of the major players in the philanthropic efforts in Africa, what he's trying to do is eradicate diseases that are in fact eradicated in the United States. And if you look at the total amount of foreign aid that we give to Africa, it's minuscule compared to those that we give to nations which we think have more strategic importance for the United States than do any of the nations in Africa. But I'll take the other part of your question just as seriously as that. Has there been a sense that that poor person down at the end of the block belongs in some other country that's as far away as Africa? I think that, I mean, in the mind, this is the argument that what's the right word to say it? I don't want to call Charles Murray a writer on the ramparts, but he likes to think of himself sometimes as a writer on the right-wing ramparts. That's what he's worried about, is that there has been, in discussions about poverty, discussions about wages, in discussions about jobs, there has been a sort of rolling back of a concern with persons in the United States who find themselves up against extremely hard times.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about your emphasis in your hopeful mood. I know it's just one of your moods on collectives and shared origins, social origins, deeper appreciation of what's collective and shared as a matter of fact. I would have thought that what's really important is concern for those in need. And for myself, if it was concern for those in most need when they're in Africa, that would be fine as well. And that's what's missing. If that's what's, if you'll forgive the expression, morally important, reliance on shared origins, a genuine collective, maybe not just distracted from what's morally important, but a reliance on what isn't anymore. Thank goodness for immigration, Americans tend not to have a shared origins as they do, and what's visible and public and okay is much, 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 much more diverse than we were when we were growing up. And that fracture seems to me to be terrific. We believe in callousness. Concern for others, social movements based on outrage, well, the Occupies, coalitions that make them temporarily affected politically, might lead to legislation that does good and that creates its own constituency. Isn't that a plausible way forward that has nothing to do with making more salient collectivity as such in social thought? Collectivity as opposed to mutual concern.
That's an interesting thought, Dick, and I'm not sure I've got myself inside your language fully enough to answer it as well as I should. Certainly on the back of any historian's mind who thinks about this period now is the period of the first part of the 20th century, the so-called progressive years, when you had the beginnings both of an articulated language of the social coming out of the social scientists and others, and you had collective movements on the ground in politics, in labor, and elsewhere. It was also a time of very, very high immigration. It was a time when, in fact, the United States was not monocultural, but more multicultural than it is even now. Since the immigrants of the early end of the 19th century, early 20th century, basically unskilled persons seeking work wherever they could along the Atlantic, as opposed to our immigration laws now, which bring so many highly skilled persons from abroad into the mix. But I think that at that moment, a sense of the of concern and of collective relationship were closely tied together. And so most discussions I know in the early part of the 20th century about poverty, why were the poor a moral problem to you? When the social Darwinist said, I mean, William Graham Sumner said most famously, the poor man in the gutter is where he deserves to be, because in the laws of the survival of the fittest, he is where he ought to be, out of the system of reproduction. So when you see him in the gutter, just notice that nature's doing what nature ought to be doing. Against that, the progressives argued both for an actual personal relationship with persons in poverty and a collective a consequence of large numbers of persons in poverty. And they did that together. I don't think we'll have to talk about that more. Yes? Yeah, you.
Yeah, I just wanted to, Steve, you mentioned earlier in your talk, actually, before you got into the various scenarios, actually, you have an interesting quote about the control of what people think about and how people are conditioned to think within particular parameters and how that can shift and the change in economics. I think right now we're going through something of a shift in how we think about politics just as a process in which the final stages of disillusionment have come out. I see folks looking at politics almost as if it was professional wrestling. They use the term kayfabe. You know, they pretend not to get along, but they both sides want to cut our Social Security. Both, you know, they're all taking money from Goldman Sachs. You know, the illusion that they're actually really that upset with each other is no longer whole. And there's much more of a sense that much of this is a charade to distract us from the general unity of purpose that they have in doing us. So I'm just wondering if that could be the beginnings of a new sort of collective rebirth of citizen empowered politics.
Power to the cynics. Yeah. No, I mean, I think you have, there's a really important point that you're making, that is, you don't change the world without getting your nose into the realism of how it works. That was one of the gifts of the muckrakers in the early part of the 20th century. It was one of the gifts of the social critics in the 1960s. We remember the kids with the sunflowers stenciled on their T-shirts, but they weren't nearly as important as say, a Michael Harrington or a C. Wright Mills in opening up people's eyes about the world they were living in. I one side of me says, losing my voice, that politics hasn't been very different in the past. It's been there's been games, drama, internal stuff, but the theater of politics that we're now exposed to is so different than it once was, because it once was that you would memorize the speeches of whatever the most eloquent senator that you knew was, and you would learn to sound like William Jennings Bryan. He wasn't a senator, but of course an orator of enormous power, or to be able to sound like President Theodore Roosevelt with his high, squeaky voice, but his really quite extraordinary vocabulary. Now, when you think about the theater of politics, you actually, since we don't see what goes on, and what goes on in the halls is not what really goes on, what we see are the talk shows, and that is utterly a wrestling match. And we imagine now that that's what it is all the way down. It's another case where the word pictures or the visual pictures in our head are so important.
Yeah. So I really appreciate the kind of the different variables, the different factors that you look at in this breakdown of the language of the social. But I just have a question about the first example that you give, which is the account of economics in the 1970s. And I think that there's a way in which, placing that alongside the evaporation of the we in contemporary academic discourse of, critical legal or critical race studies or postmodern feminism, whatever, is potentially misleading in a way. And I guess what I would, be to ask you to respond to this, because it's not just that economics in the 1970s you know, turned away from macroeconomics, but that the language of economics and economic ways of viewing social life and moral life spread throughout other disciplines, right? So it's in political science, it's in sociology, it's in law. It's implemented in policy, whether that be the form of the Washington Consensus, or whether that be IMF and World Bank policies, whether that be the Bremer policies, and I mean, you can like produce. So it seems like, you know, economics is a sign, and I realize this is just a sketch, and I've read a good part of your book, but I mean, there's, you know, a kind of more complicated analysis, but it seems like the way in which you presented it, economics as one among many other factors, seems to me a little bit misleading to maybe get economics, a certain kind of economic way of viewing the social world and fracturing social world kind of off the hook. And that would be, you know, but for lack of a better term, it's a term that's used too much, just be called neoliberalism, right? And neoliberalism and its proliferation in all kinds of different policy arenas. School vouchers is a good example of neoliberalism applied to education policy and so on. So I just
Have to figure out more. Well, no, you're absolutely right, and there is a proliferation of precisely these ways of understanding not only the world but also the very act of social analysis, which comes straight out of these microeconomic theorists and races through politics, and does create, as it were, the neoliberal policy agenda of the present time. But is that all that there is? Or can we also not say that somewhere out of the, in some ways, the very strengths of the left, which was a recognition of diversity of persons, it was a recognition of the increasing recognition of the need to talk in plurals, where, say, 1930s radicals had not, this, in its own way, helped to create a world picture, which was not the same as a neoliberal world picture, but could cohabit with it more comfortably than one might have expected.
I mean, let me just put it this way. It seems like that argument, it resonates very closely with familiar argument. Mark Lillis, one person who's made this argument, there are many others, who say, you know, look at the 1960s, look at the cultural politics of the 1960s, and you see two different strands of libertarianism that grow out of it. One comes from the counterculture, one comes from the resurgent right wing, and both of them are they resonate in this contemporary condition where we have no sense of a common social we. And they can both be kind of rooted to the politics of that moment, but it's about two different strands of libertarianism, one left, one right, that come together and kind of, that seems to, when I read the book, I didn't think that was exactly your position, and now I'm thinking maybe that is a little bit closer to your position.
I wouldn't put it quite that simply. It doesn't all trace out of the 1960s either. One of the arguments I try to make in the book is that in fact, there are real solidarity movements that split and struggle in their own terms. But is there, I think I would have to think a little bit harder to see if there are other cases where we can say that groups who find themselves arguing for very different kinds of policies, who imagine themselves really quite starkly opposed, nonetheless live within the same universe of assumptions. And that's all the claim that I would make here.
Maybe one more quick question and then lock it closed, but I'm sure Dan would be going to chat some more afterwards. Yes?
I feel a little bit guilty bringing this up because I'm trying to learn how to use it in the public sector, and that is personalization of messaging. And what really resonated when you said that the skills of the political parties has been greatly enhanced, that results in identifying individual like the voters and where they are, and it relates to the gerrymandering. And we live in a world of very big data and very good analytical tools. And a marketing technology that never really existed before. And I guess, you know, I guess you could say, well, it's a neutral tool. It could be used for all different purposes. But it just seems to be one which can lead to, you know, at least three of your four scenarios.
Well, I'll make a statement that's too brash. No tools are neutral. Axes weren't really a good invention if you were a tree. And so I think the tool has consequences.